Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. Hard to follow that. I hope your mimosas and Bloody Marys are ready. Nuclear! And there you go. Way to start off a good program. Our guest today is UVA Professor Todd Sexer from the Department of Politics, Woodrow Wilson's Department of Politics. Good morning, Professor.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy, and recently named a senior fellow at the Miller Center. How do you find the time?
The time finds me.
We will be talking about North Korea and everything that that means to the world. Professor Sexer specializes in questions of international security along with research interests, including military coercion, reputations, and international relations, the strategic effects on nuclear weapons, and the sources and consequences of military doctrine. His dissertation won the 2008 Walter Isert Award for the best dissertation in peace science. I am so happy to have you on the program. So are you ready for 60 minutes worth of worthwhile discussion about North Korea here on WPVC?
I'm ready.
You know, I invited you to come on the program about 3 weeks ago, I think, so we could talk about this, because North Korea was at the top of the hour in every news program. North Korea is still certainly in the top 15 minutes of every news program, I believe. And my first question to you, something I rarely open with any guest, is please tell me about your dissertation and how you, what it was that won the top award for peace science.
Well, thanks. That's a good question. One of my central research questions that I've been studying for the last 10 years is about coercive diplomacy. So when countries use military threats to try to get what they want, when does it work and when does it fail? And one of the interesting things that we see over time is that countries that have a lot of military power actually do not do a very good job in making successful coercive threats. And ironic that you would ask me about that in a segment when we're talking about North Korea, because that's exactly what we're seeing. The United States making a long sequence of coercive threats over a period of really decades, threats that turn out to be not very effective. And so my research, both in graduate school and here at UVA, has been about what's going on. Why are those threats not working? And I think one of the big reasons is that a country like the United States, the Soviet Union during the Cold War, other powerful countries have difficult time convincing their adversaries that if their adversary gives in to the threat today, it won't lead to more threats tomorrow. And so my research has been about testing and demonstrating that pattern over time.
The speed with which North Korea has increased their nuclear technology over the past one plus year. Let's talk about that for a bit. It seems incredibly rapid, at least to me. Can you talk about that for a bit? How rapid has it been? I mean, it seems somewhat like the speed with which, you know, people have gone from the printing press to you know, the motor engine to the plane to, you know, and I realize I'm exaggerating a bit, but it seems that their knowledge has increased dramatically.
The term I would use is probably not rapid, but maybe sudden. And the reason is that the North Koreans have been researching nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles for decades. And they've experienced some success. You know, this past year was very significant in terms of their technological progress on both of those things. But it hasn't been rapid in the sense that the United States, Soviet Union, other countries that acquired nuclear weapons were able to make much more rapid progress once they began researching these technologies. It's just that North Korea's progress has been sudden. For a couple of decades, the North Koreans have been essentially the laughingstock of the world in terms of failed nuclear tests, failed ballistic missile tests, technological progress that was moving very slowly. But then suddenly last year, there were two big steps that they made. The first step was they successfully tested an intercontinental ballistic missile. And this is different from the ballistic missiles that they had before because they were not able to reach the United States up until last year. And now with the missiles that they've tested, they can reach, we think, probably all of the United States with their ballistic missiles. And then the second big leap that they made was successfully testing what seems to be a thermonuclear weapon. And that's a significant leap because a thermonuclear weapon is essentially a more powerful kind of nuclear weapon. It uses a traditional small nuclear explosion to trigger a much larger explosion that uses hydrogen as fuel and essentially triggers a fusion process with hydrogen isotopes. And so you can get much, much bigger explosions. So consider that their largest nuclear test to date prior to last year had been about equivalent to about 15,000 tons of TNT, which is about the size of the bomb that the United States dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. Their most recent nuclear test, which was in September of 2017, was somewhere around 100,000 tons of TNT or 100 kilotons. Now, thermonuclear weapons can get much, much larger than that. The Soviets tested a thermonuclear weapon that was in the range of 60 million tons of TNT or 60 megatons. The largest nuclear weapon that the United States ever tested was somewhere around 15 megatons. So the North Koreans are far, far away from that. But their ability to successfully conduct a hydrogen bomb, a thermonuclear test, is really a significant leap. So the North Koreans are both getting better at being able to build powerful nuclear weapons as well as being able to build ballistic missiles that can reach the United States.
Is this sudden learning ability, is this all coming intra-state, or is this coming with the help of other countries?
For the most part, as far as we can tell, this is indigenous. This is all the North Koreans doing this themselves. Now, the North Koreans have been trying to get help from other countries and trying to find tidbits where they can find them. But for the most part, this is indigenously developed technology, which is quite remarkable. But it also explains in part why it's taken them so long to do it, that they're almost entirely self-reliant.
Again, our guest today, Professor Todd Sexer from the University of Virginia, from the Department of Politics and the School of Leadership and Public Policy. Professor, they've also had several serious accidents as well. Earthquakes and explosions, some expected, some not. Is that correct?
Well, one of the hallmarks of North Korea's missile program up to this point has been failed tests. And in part, these are these have been a consequence of inadequate North Korean technology and just the fits and starts that go along with trying to develop ballistic missiles when the rest of the world is trying to stop you. And part of the failed track record has been, we think at least in part, the responsibility of the United States. So about 4 years ago, President Obama ordered the U.S. military to step up its top secret cyber and electronic warfare attacks against North Korea's ballistic missile program. And over that period of time, there were a large number of North Korean missile tests where the missiles exploded very shortly after launch or on the launch pad. And this is no coincidence. This is at least in part orchestrated by the United States. But now North Korea seems to be getting better at preventing those cyber attacks and conducting missile tests that are more successful.
Are all these accidents from the nuclear test, though? I mean, they had a mountain collapse. Is that correct? They had earthquakes. They had are these from intentional nuclear tests? Or are these just from accidents?
Well, these are, we don't know for sure what the source of these, seismic events are. The convenient thing about nuclear tests is they produce a lot of seismic data. And so that's how we're in part able to detect the fact that that these nuclear tests occurred. And they do have geological consequences. There can be small earthquakes and tremors that are caused by, shifts in the earth as a result of an underground explosion. So North Korea's nuclear tests have been underground, which is different from the way that the U.S. and the Soviet Union used to conduct nuclear tests.
That's strictly from trying to hide them?
That's not from trying to hide them. That's right. It's not like they can get better data from conducting it underground, but they can contain the fallout, number one, and so minimize the external political, figurative fallout from these tests. And number two, they can try to conceal the location. So whereas it's easy to get good seismic data to measure the size of a nuclear explosion that takes place underground, but it's harder to pinpoint the exact location of the test. Now, that's not to say it's impossible, and people in the United States have been able to do that by using seismic data and triangulate it with other information that's available out there. But it's harder to pinpoint the test site when the test is conducted underground.
So let's talk about how is the current nuclear issue between the U.S. and North Korea. Is that the greatest potential nuclear war in the world at this moment?
It's hard to say exactly what is the greatest nuclear threat. But I'd say there's really two big flashpoints. One is North Korea, of course. And the other is probably India and Pakistan. And they really vacillate back and forth. Now, India and Pakistan have not had a really serious nuclear crisis in probably about a decade and a half. So I think for many experts, for me also, I think they've fallen down on the list of serious nuclear flashpoints, which is not to say they've disappeared. But I think the North Korea flashpoint is more severe today. We see inflammatory rhetoric being passed back and forth between the U.S. and North Korea. You've got 1.2 million North Korean soldiers, many of whom are sitting on the border with South Korea. You've got 10,000, 12,000 artillery guns sitting about 50 miles away from the capital of Seoul. For listeners in Charlottesville, that's about the distance between Charlottesville and Stanton. So imagine 12,000 artillery guns sitting pointed at Charlottesville from Stanton. That's how close they are. And the risk to me is not that somebody will intentionally push the button and launch a nuclear weapon. The risk for me, in my view, is a risk of an accident. That in the middle of heated rhetoric being traded back and forth, the North Koreans get a false report that a U.S. attack is incoming, or a false warning or an accident happens at a U.S. radar station and there's a false indicator that a North Korean attack is incoming. Those have happened before, and if they were to happen in the middle of a period of very high tension or heated rhetoric between the U.S. and North Korea, I think the chances of an accidental event leading to a war are higher than I would like them to be.
Are the leaders in India and Pakistan of the same mindset as the current leaders between North Korea and the United States?
No. to say the least, no. They have not been trading, veiled threats back and forth for a long time. They still have disputes, but they've had a longer period of time to try to work out those disputes and to establish channels of communication that would prevent an accident or something unintentional from escalating to a high nuclear level.
Again, our guest today is Professor Todd Sexer. He's from UVA's Department of Politics and the Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy. So let's talk about this for a bit as we talk about North Korea and United States. I'm going to skip over a few things, but while we're talking about the leadership of North Korea and the United States, I found this, and I believe it was one of your writings as I did my homework, something that you had called the madman myth. So let's talk about that for a bit. We're going to take a break shortly, and I believe this is going to be in between, go before and after. But let's talk about the pros and cons of both being somewhat of a madman and projecting a madman with unpredictability while being in charge. So take over.
So this idea comes out of classic nuclear deterrence theory. And let's take a step back about 50 years to the 1950s and 1960s, when you had the U.S. and the Soviet Union facing off in a period of really perpetual tension, conflicts over Cuba, conflicts over West Berlin, and all around the world. And each country has tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, or at least thousands in the 1960s. And the question is, how do you get leverage out of those nuclear weapons? And the problem that the U.S. and the Soviet Union faced was that each side had thousands of nuclear weapons that they could launch against the other. So how could you threaten credibly to launch a nuclear attack against your adversary when you know that a nuclear attack would be launched in retaliation? And that was the central problem that leaders faced and that scholars thinking about nuclear deterrence faced as well. How do you credibly threaten to use nuclear weapons in a crisis if you want to get leverage out of them? And the answer that some people gave, controversially, but I think also very interesting, was that you can't threaten to credibly use nuclear weapons intentionally, but you can raise the level of tension in a crisis to the point where it's possible and maybe even likely that an accident or an unauthorized step might occur that would drag the two sides into a nuclear war that they wanted to avoid.
All right, let's take a quick break, and come back and continue this. The madman myth is part of our discussion with Professor Todd Sexer from UVA's Miller Center, professor of politics. Hang tight here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. A rainy day, so you're right where you should be, listening to the radio. Driving safely, if that's where you are, listening to 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Here I am with UVA's Professor Todd Sexer, and we're talking about the madman myth, the pros and cons of either being a madman or at least projecting that you are one in terms of having access to nuclear button and being able to push it. So continue on, Professor.
So here's the basic problem in a nuclear crisis. If two leaders are rational and sane, then nobody would ever launch their nuclear weapons against the other side because they know that they'd be hit back and it would be devastating. So the solution that some scholars came up with was to, instead of trying to threaten nuclear conflict intentionally, to try to get to a point by raising tension in a crisis such that an accident or an inadvertent step might drag the two sides unintentionally into a nuclear conflict. So think back to your high school history class, if you learned about the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the U.S. and the Soviet Union were facing off over this question of Soviet missiles that were placed in Cuba. And the U.S. wanted the missiles out, and the Soviets said no. And the two sides raised the tension over a period of 2 weeks in 1962, raised the tension so high that toward the end of the crisis, accidents were starting to happen. So one accident was that a U-2 spy plane that was flown by the United States was flying over Cuba and was shot down by somebody acting without orders from Moscow. So it was an unauthorized attack on that spy plane, shot down, and constituted the only casualty in the crisis, a U.S. pilot. Another example was that a U.S. spy plane flying near the North Pole got confused by the Northern Lights, and instead of returning back to base at the end of his flight, started flying straight toward the Soviet Union. And had he crossed into Soviet territory, he could have been shot down. The Soviets might have thought that a U.S. attack was underway or being prepared. Both of these events were inadvertent, were unintentional, and they had the effect of unnerving Soviet leaders so much that the Soviet premier decided to back down in the crisis. And so scholars took this example to heart and started to say, well, the advantage of nuclear weapons in a crisis is that they create the risk that the two sides might unintentionally fall into the trap of nuclear war. And so a crisis is really about who has the stronger stomach. Well, some leaders have taken this even a step further and said, well, instead of acting rationally but raising tension, what if I act irrational and try to convey to the other side that I'm a little bit crazy? So Richard Nixon tried to do this. He called this his madman theory. In 1969, he was trying to pressure the Soviets into getting the North Vietnamese to make concessions that would end the Vietnam War. And he wasn't getting anywhere. And so he and his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, came up with this plan. And they said, well, we can't credibly threaten to attack the Soviets if they don't pressure the North Vietnamese. But we can act as if President Nixon is a little bit crazy and unafraid of nuclear conflict and try to scare the Soviets into pushing North Vietnam into ending this conflict. And so what they did is they devised a plan where, among other things, U.S. submarines would start, U.S. naval vessels would start monitoring Soviet shipping traffic in the Bering Strait, which was pretty unusual. And then most provocatively, they ordered a contingent of U.S. B-52 bombers to fly straight toward the Soviet Union, pull back at the last minute, and fly in an orbital pattern near the Soviet border. And what they hoped this would do, and they also ordered U.S. diplomats to convey to their Soviet counterparts that Nixon was just a little bit crazy, hasn't been sleeping a lot lately, and might be willing to do anything to end the conflict in Vietnam. And the Soviets were completely perplexed by these moves. They had no idea what Nixon was trying to convey, didn't understand the message and the signal that he was trying to send at all. And so the U.S. ended up terminating the operation completely and with no political, no diplomatic effect at all. But there's still this argument out there, and I think one that has been at least implicitly made, if not explicitly, by President Trump, which is that it's good to be unpredictable, good to pretend that you're a little bit crazy. You might be willing to go to war. You might be willing to endure severe costs to achieve your political goals. And that's one that I think is perpetuated in the media even today.
But as someone who is involved, as yourself, in relations, how does that work if the person on the other side is also occasionally listed as a madman?
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem with this argument is that, especially as a world leader, it's pretty hard to convince your adversary that you're not rational. Kim Jong-un, North Korea's leader, is often portrayed in the U.S. media, I think, as irrational, crazy. And I think he's exactly the opposite. He has been nothing if not shrewd and calculating in his maneuverings, both domestically in trying to consolidate power when he came to power in 2011, as well as internationally in trying to make sure that a cohesive international coalition does not emerge to try to compel him to get rid of his nuclear program. So I don't think Kim Jong-un is irrational. Donald Trump may be unpredictable in the way that he uses his Twitter account. But that's not the same as saying that he would be willing to start a war that could escalate to a nuclear conflict over North Korea's nuclear and missile program. So the problem with the madman theory is it just doesn't have a good historical track record of succeeding. It's hard to convince an adversary that you're truly irrational and unpredictable. And then even if you could, imagine trying to negotiate with somebody that you thought was fundamentally unpredictable and irrational. The reason that you would make a concession to them is that you could predict what they would do in response. You would be able to predict that they would back down in the crisis and not attack you. But if you really think they're irrational, then there's really no reason to think that making a concession to them would achieve the desired effect. And so even if you can convince your adversary that you truly are unpredictable and irrational, that doesn't mean that it's going to get you any negotiating leverage in a crisis.
Again, our guest today, Professor Todd Sexer from University of Virginia, the School of Leadership and Public Policy. He's a professor of politics, 30 minutes after the hour. You use the word shrewd for North Korea's President Kim. Let me bring this up. Get your thoughts on it. My reading says that President Kim usually gives his thoughts on North Korea on the first of the year. Every year, is that correct?
I think that's right.
And so on 2017, he made a comment about how the military and nuclear had reached its final stage of preparation, and that they would launch an intercontinental ballistic missile during the year. And then they did, and launched its first missile on July 4th. Now, if that doesn't seem to be a shrewd statement, of someone who is not a madman, I would say you're wrong. I mean, that to me, that seems to be quite a shrewd person. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts?
He certainly knows how to get attention. And, you know, maybe it's useful to back up a little bit. You know, the United States and North Korea signed an armistice in 1953, which ended the Korean War, but they never signed a formal peace treaty. And North Korea, ever since, has been motivated in part by this fact that the United States and North Korea are technically still at war, which many listeners might not be aware of. That war never formally ended, and that's at the same time in 1953 is when the U.S. and the South Koreans formally struck an alliance, which today has culminated in, you know, tens of thousands of U.S. troops being based in South Korea to defend them in time of war. So one of North Korea's central goals for a long, long time has been to be able to threaten the United States with nuclear retaliation if the United States were to ever try to launch a war against North Korea, try to assassinate its leaders. The North Koreans have wanted to be able to hold that card out as a potential threat. But only this year have they been able to really succeed in successfully testing the technology that would allow them to do that. And if you want to develop a successful nuclear deterrent, your goal is to never have to use it. Your goal is to display it in a convincing way to the other side so that you don't ever have to use your nuclear weapons. And that's precisely what they're doing. They're conducting very public, very high-profile tests of their technology in a way that communicates to the United States and the rest of the world what they have, because their goal is to show everybody that they're not to be trifled with so that they never have to actually use their nuclear weapons.
So when it comes to negotiating, we have the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who at least when speaking talks about negotiations. And then we have President Trump, who seems to be much more of a domineering and warmongering type voice when it comes to North Korea. What do you see happening here? And what is the voice between the two that North Korea is hearing?
Well, I don't know how North Korea interprets these conflicting messages, but they are conflicting. And that can be problematic, I think, in international negotiations. You want to speak with a single voice. And as the president, you want your Secretary of State and your other cabinet officials to... You want other countries to be confident that those officials are speaking for you. And the problem with President Trump sometimes publicly undermining Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is that it can communicate to the other side that Secretary Tillerson is not actually speaking for the president, that the two are at odds, and that the U.S. has not developed a cohesive and consistent policy internally. Now, again, I don't know what the North Koreans are reading into these statements. I don't know how they interpret the gap that sometimes exists between Secretary Tillerson and President Trump, but it is certainly not a conventional approach to have the secretary make one statement about being open to negotiations on the one hand, and then the president come out shortly afterward and undermine that statement.
But when Rex Tillerson speaks, the rest of the world seems to point to him and say, there you go, let's do that. And not that President Trump often cares what the rest of the world says, But but when the rest of the world says, let's do that, are there any moments when you think that that might win as a negotiating tool? I mean, it's one thing when we're talking about building a wall or whether or not to move the city, the capital city in Israel or some other items. But when we're talking about a true global issue, and might it be working when we're talking about North Korea actually chooses to do something with South Korea? Could the negotiating tool be working? Mm-hmm. Words be working?
It's possible. You know, this would not be the first time that a president has used a cabinet secretary to float an idea and then disavowed the idea. But floating the trial balloon to see what the public reaction is, see what the adversary's reaction is. And sometimes those reactions are positive from both sides. The North Koreans would love to have a negotiation that allows them to keep their nuclear program, formally ends the Korean War from the 1950s, and maybe walks back some of the international sanctions that are currently stifling their economy. But that's not to say that the United States is willing to give any of those things. So when Secretary Tillerson announces that the U.S. is willing to talk, and then President Trump disavows that statement, that may be a subtle message to the North Koreans that a negotiation might be possible, but they shouldn't get their hopes up. I mean, this is all a game of posturing and positioning. In a negotiation, of course, you never want to reveal up front what you're willing to give. So we don't know what the Trump administration is willing to give, if anything. And we also don't know what the North Koreans are willing to give. But there is this public effect, I think, of revealing to at least the Trump administration how the international community would react if the U.S. were to offer to negotiate. But again, we don't know where those negotiations would lead, and a negotiation is just that. It's just people talking. That doesn't mean that either side would make any concessions, and there have been plenty of instances in the past 20 years where the U.S. and the North Koreans have negotiated, often with other countries at the table, where the negotiations led absolutely nowhere, or where the North Koreans made promises that they then disavowed or secretly cheated on. So negotiation doesn't mean the end of the dispute. But there is this effect of revealing what the international community's reaction would be if a negotiation were to take place.
Our guest today, Professor Todd Sexer from University of Virginia, Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics. Professor Sexer will be participating in the 2018 Virginia Festival of the Books. Both sides now taking diplomacy seriously. City Council Chambers Thursday, March 22nd at 4 p.m. We'll talk about that a little bit more in the last third of the hour as well. Hang tight. And we're back here on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. This is 94.7 WPVC. Thanks so much for being with us on your rainy Sunday morning. Professor Sexer, we were talking about the Olympics. Do you see that as actually doing anything? If not with the United States, is it leading anywhere with South Korea?
It's possible. And I want to make this point about the public effect of diplomacy. You know, you mentioned that when Secretary of State Rex Tillerson makes an offer to negotiate, it has ripple effects, not just in the U.S. and North Korea, but around the world. And one thing that one of the developments that's happened over the last several weeks is that the North Koreans have offered to compete jointly with South Korea in the upcoming Winter Olympics. And that's pretty interesting, and that's a pretty significant event. But I want to add or want to make sort of one observation about that, which is that the effect might not be as straightforward as we think. If you're North Korea, one of your strategic objectives has to be to split the United States and South Korea, get them on different pages in terms of this crisis. And the North Koreans have been trying to do this for a long time. With some success, I will say. And even today, President Moon of South Korea is much more dovish toward North Korea than President Trump is. And that is partly for good reason. He's sitting on the border with North Korea, whereas the United States is thousands of miles away. And so he's got to suffer the costs of anything that goes wrong. But at the same time, this provides a window that the North Koreans can potentially exploit. And we may be seeing that happening right now with the case of the Olympics. With North Korea making this overture. It's a small overture, and they've made small overtures before, so this is not a significant concession by any means. It's purely symbolic, but at the same time, what it could have the effect of doing is persuading the South Koreans that more diplomacy and more concessions will get them what they want and draw an end to this crisis and reduce tension. Whereas I think the Trump administration is much more skeptical that that is possible and that concessions will really get the U.S. and South Korea where they want to be. But by making this overture, then North Korea helps push the U.S. and the South Koreans just a little bit further apart than they were before, which can be to North Korea's advantage.
So you envision this Olympic gesture to be much more long-term than I have read it to be in the newspapers. Many people, or at least it's being presented in a lot of the more public papers, a lot of the more general newspapers, it's being presented as being a very short-term gesture. Go to the Olympics, see the hockey players, see the North Korean cheerleaders, and then it's over.
Right. Well, it's a short-term gesture with very little consequence outside of the athletes that are competing on these teams. But these messages accumulate, and it's sort of one more drop in the bucket of an attempt to persuade South Korea that diplomacy can work and concessions are necessary, and pushes the South Koreans in a slightly different direction than the Americans.
So let's talk about something a little less diplomatic. North Korea has, I believe, through mid-December, 6 nuclear tests, 2 successful launches. They may have had, I think they've had other launches, but 2 successful launches of ICBMs. And they've reached the point now where they've sent missiles in arcs over Japan, one in August, one in September, I believe. Japan is now conducting public missile drills, much like what happened in Hawaii.
Right.
In fact, I think Japan had its own false warning.
That's right.
Similar to what happened in Hawaii, Japan had its own accidental drill. So I want to just talk about that for a minute. Why are they doing this over Hawaii? Is this their way of getting back at an old, an old enemy?
Well, just to be clear, they're not. They're firing the missiles over Japan, not over Hawaii.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. Just to be clear, they fired no ballistic missiles anywhere near
the
United States.
Thank you for the correction.
But
although they could,
part of the reason is there's really nowhere else to go. These missile tests have been in the range of 2,000 to 3,000 kilometers. No, that's not right. About 1,000 kilometers in terms of distance on land. And that's much too long to stay within the borders of North Korea. So the missile has to go somewhere, and they don't want the missile landing in China.
And then because they're on the edge of the continent, that's where they have to go next.
That's right. So the best place to put the missile when it lands is in the ocean. And so you've got to get it over Japan. So it's purely a fact of geography. I think any signal that is being sent to Japan is maybe a bonus, or maybe an inadvertent drawback. But it's a necessary
drawback. Are they telling Japan, by the way, this is coming your way? We're not aiming this at you. Are they giving them a warning?
The United States gives them the warning. And the Japanese can see the launches themselves.
Korea saying, this is not aimed at you, this is just a test?
No, these are not formally announced and notified in the way that other missile tests might be. I don't think they're sending a message necessarily to Japan. The message is intended to be sent to the United States and South Korea. But of course, the Japanese are very worried about this. At the very least, they're worried about a missile accidentally landing on their territory.
I think I read that during the missile drills, they have less than 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. If it were to be aimed at Japan.
That's right.
And you're saying that at this point anyway, that they're not, it would take 10 minutes, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't know for three, it would take 3 minutes to determine that it's coming at them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, consider that if North Korea launched a ballistic missile at the United States, it would take somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 minutes. And the United States is much further away than Japan is. So they're next door for all practical purposes. And they really do have only a matter of minutes. Now, I don't think the North Koreans have any interest in launching a ballistic missile against Japan. There are no targets there that they have any interest in hitting, except for, U.S. forces. But those tests certainly have the effect of unnerving the Japanese public.
You wouldn't hit your neighbor and say, next is you, if you don't stop this?
I don't think that's in their interest.
Nobody
knows what North Korea would do, but I don't think they would.
Is that a way of negotiating?
Not a very effective way, I think.
Something else I believe was, is this one of your works that I read? All soldiers are less war prone than statesmen.
Yeah, this was a study I conducted about 14 or 15 years ago, which basically asked the question, what happens when ex-military or current military officers come into power in a country? There's sort of an old school view that says that, military officers that are trained in the ways of war are more likely to use military force, more eager to launch attacks against other countries and tend to use the military as opposed to other tools of diplomacy. But then there's a contrary view, which I think is convincing, which says that soldiers, especially those who have served in combat, are much more cautious about using military force because they've seen what happens when countries go to war, and they've seen the costs and the human devastation that happens. And what I found was that civilian control of the military, which is an institution we have in the United States, where the military... A military officer is never the ultimate commander, the commander-in-chief of U.S. forces. It's the president, who's a civilian. That plays a big role in the answer to that question. We often find that military officers tend to be eager. You know, we can look throughout the history of the Cold War and after. Sometimes officers are eager to recommend a military action, but that tends not to be true in countries with strong civilian control of the military. In other countries, that's less true. In countries like Pakistan, which had a military leader as president for a long time, Pervez Musharraf, we tend to observe that those military officers tend to be a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more eager to use force. But in the United States, we don't find that. We find, you know, cases that are much more like Colin Powell, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the Gulf War in 1991 against Iraq, who are much more cautious about using force, sometimes more cautious than civilians.
Do you think that President Trump might be, or having so many military men as his counsel, will actually help keep him from war with North Korea?
I think it does help, actually. I think military officers can offer, especially in the United States, we have the best trained military officers in the world, can offer a much more sober and cautious assessment about what military force can and cannot accomplish. So I do think that that can be an advantage.
53 minutes after the hour with our guest today, Professor Todd Sexer, as we talk about North Korea. He is a senior fellow at the Miller Center, professor of politics at the University of Virginia. Professor, the doomsday clock ticked forward 30 seconds, now 2 minutes to midnight. Is that truly concerning, or is that just a headline on the newspaper?
Well, it's hard to know. As far as I know, the doomsday clock is not based on any scientific assessment. And it's also, to my knowledge, based on now on risks that are broader than just nuclear conflict. What the risks that they're building into this measurement are, things like global warming, other catastrophic events that might happen. But I think it reflects a couple of things. One is it reflects the willingness of the U.S. and North Korea to raise nuclear tensions, which is historically increasingly rare. Since the end of the Cold War, I think a lot of people, certainly in the United States, really had forgotten about nuclear weapons and forgotten that literally thousands and thousands of them still exist. The United States alone has more than 6,000 nuclear weapons, close to 7,000. Russia has about the same number. Nuclear weapons haven't gone away. And the United States and North Korea have been engaged in this sort of slow motion crisis for a long time now about North Korea's nuclear program. And in the past year, we've seen rhetoric get more and more heated between those two countries. That's unusual. Most of the time, cooler heads prevail and nuclear countries go to great pains to try to reduce the level of tension because they know what the consequences might be. A second thing that I think has been going on is that the United States is pursuing a strategy where it is actually trying to make nuclear weapons more usable. So a draft of the new U.S. nuclear strategy, a document called the Nuclear Posture Review, which was last conducted by the Obama administration in 2010, I believe, a draft of that new document, the Trump administration's version of that document, has just been released. Or just been leaked. And one of the aspects of that document that was surprising was that the U.S., for the first time in at least 20 years, will now, assuming it stays in the final document, will now, as a matter of policy, threaten to use nuclear weapons to retaliate against non-nuclear attacks. And that also is unusual. And what both the United States and Russia have been trying to do, or mostly Russia over the last several years, is develop a nuclear doctrine which calls for the use of smaller and smaller nuclear weapons. And this doctrine that the U.S., this document that the U.S. is, you know, is still a draft, but is in process, calls to match that strategy. And this has the effect of essentially making nuclear weapons more usable. So we're not talking about the huge city-leveling multi-megaton nuclear weapons that, you know, that are in the movies and that we think of when we think about nuclear weapons. We're talking about much smaller nuclear weapons, the size of the Hiroshima bomb or sometimes even smaller. But one of the interesting factor or features about the nuclear age is that over time, there has been really a taboo, or at least a very strong norm has emerged against the use of nuclear weapons. When, you know, somebody that threatens to use nuclear weapons or that might actually use them is really crossing a serious threshold. And the problem with pursuing a strategy that involves smaller nuclear weapons is that it makes that threshold easier to cross. And once it's crossed, we don't know what the consequences will be. And I think the, you know, the ticking closer to midnight of this doomsday clock is a reflection of the fact that the status of the nuclear taboo and this strong prohibition against using nuclear weapons that has existed for many decades, I think is more and more uncertain. And we don't know whether it will hold over the coming decades.
So, Professor, we've got 60 seconds left. A question for you is, currently the president has unilateral authority to launch an attack. Mm-hmm. I'd like to get your thoughts on whether that should be changed or not.
That authority emerged during the Cold War when we were engaged in crises where we might have a few minutes at most to respond to an incoming nuclear attack. We don't face that kind of pressure anymore. We have ballistic missiles that are on submarines that are very difficult to find. We are facing adversaries like North Korea that have absolutely no ability to threaten the integrity of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. If a nuclear attack were to happen against the United States, there's no reason that we would have to respond within a few minutes. We could take hours or even days to do it. So the need for that unilateral emergency authority, I think, is much less severe than it used to be. And I think creating a process that brings in more players and allows for a more deliberative process is very necessary and a smart thing to do in this age.
Our guest today, Professor Todd Sexer. You can find him at the Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics or the Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy. He's also a senior fellow at the Miller Center. Professor, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
And we'll have you back on in the future. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Next week, Jordy Yeager talking about gentrification.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.